Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and I am just so glad to be with my friends around the world again on the Peter Bregan Hour. Today, I got an email from a pediatrician. I don't want to give out his name or location yet, but he had gotten in touch with me a few weeks ago saying that he had been thinking about my work for a long time, and he had finally decided to start telling his patients that within 3 months, he would no longer be prescribing stimulant drugs, and he would like to help them find better ways of handling their stuff with their kids and to put the kids on drugs. But if they weren't interested, they could go and find other help, and he would give them several months to do so. He got back in touch with me just to let me know how things were going, and he had contacted quite a number now of his patients, including people who are very involved in the school system. And everyone but one had said, "We like the idea." He was surprised. I am surprised. It is wonderful. It may be changing out there. Now, I got so excited about talking to him that I went to my office, back a few dozen yards to my wife's office, and I said, honey, I wanna find a place for this man, even though it's 3 weeks away. He thinks he can come to our conference. I want to do an hour with him about his wonderful experience. And I called him back, and he said he's going to try and make it. He's got a lot of kids, and he doesn't like leaving them with his wife, you know, leaving it on her shoulders for the weekend. But that he may be coming. Spontaneous. So I'm hoping for a really interesting new friend and an interesting new presentation, which gives me a lead into the conference again. Come to the conference, shake my hand, and tell me you've been listening to me on PRN FM, and it's inspired you to come to the conference. It's April 26th through 28th in Syracuse. You can find it on my website, bregan.com, B-R-E-G-G-I-N, or you can go right to it on empathictherapy.org. Empathy, empathictherapy.org. Love to see new people. Love to know that my show is reaching and encouraging you. My guest today, well, I thought my guest was Mike Bundrant. Bundrant is spelled B-U-N-D-R-A-N-T. He comes as a package. It's Mike and Hope Bundrant. I am familiar with Mike because of his marvelous writings on naturalnews.com. He's interviewed me for naturalnews.com. He's been following my work for a while, and unlike most of my guests whom I find out have been, I know he's been following my work because he's written very accurately about it. He's got very strong views of his own on psychiatry, which are very close to mine. But that's not what he wants to talk about today. He wants to talk with me and with his wife, Hope Bundrant. That's again, B-U-N-D-R-A-N-T. They're co-founders of INLP Center, and it's an online personal development center. And it's dedicated to increasing self-awareness, improving communication skills, and ending self-sabotage. I cannot think of a more important subject, except maybe love, than ending self-sabotage. Because nothing keeps us more from giving and sharing what we have to offer in this world, and nothing lands us more quickly in the grasp of psychiatry than self-sabotage. Mike and Hope, are you there?
Hi, Peter. Can you hear me?
Yeah, hi. I'm getting an hi. Hope, you say hello too, please.
Hi, Peter.
Hi. Mike, you sounded like an echo. Say hello again.
Hello.
Yeah, you're a little hollow sounding, but you're echoing.
Let me see if I can move locations here. Does that help?
No. Hope, can you hear this too, the echo?
I can hear the echo as well.
Well, I'll just talk to you for a while.
Okay.
We need Mike Bundren.
Okay.
I don't know. Yeah, I hear you. I'm still hearing a bit of an echo. Are you there, Mike? Listen, Hope, while he tries to figure it out, maybe the studio can help. Tell me about your work.
Sure. Well, with INLP Center, we focus on personal development. We have online courses that people can take online right away and to work on a number of solutions, a number of problems they're having. But our newest program is called the AHA Solution, and it's all about ending self-sabotage by understanding your psychological attachments that get in the way of the goals you really want in life.
Tell me more. I'm really willing to sit back and listen, and we'll let Mike get his act together.
Okay. Well, we've found through studying that, your basic psychological attachments are to control, to deprivation, to rejection. And when those are triggered, generally from our childhood, those are triggered from our childhood, we're able to figure out which ones we have and, oh, I think he's back on. Ones we have, and then we're able to make better choices.
Let's take a deep breath. Where is your husband now?
Okay, how about now?
Oh.
That sounds better.
Okay, we're sharing the same line. I thought it would be okay. I was on Skype and she was on the landline, but it didn't work out. So
you're at a microphone together, huddled up?
No.
Different, same line, different handsets, different rooms.
Okay. Well, you sound okay.
Okay.
Hope sounds even better. So I'm trying to get a handle. You're giving me a handle on the work you do. How long have you had this website up?
Since 2011.
And people take courses?
Yeah, we started as an NLP site. So Mike's been teaching NLP for over 20 years, and we decided to take the certifications and put them online so people can just go online and take the courses. We've created tons of videos and audio files and manuals, and people go and get their certifications. And then we started expanding into personal development programs that are kind of NLP-based, but also some that aren't NLP-based.
Did I correctly say that you call yourself the INLP, or was I mistaken about that?
INLPcenter.com.
What's the I?
Well, it kind of goes from internet to international. We have students all over the world that take our courses.
Good. Well, just tell us some more. I mean, I think this idea of self-sabotage, I call it self-destructive lifestyle. I think it's incredibly important to identify the kinds of the things we say to ourselves, if that's what you're talking about, the kinds of activities we take with other people which are bound to fail, because if we can grasp those patterns and let them go, we can grow enormously. It's not easy. I can tell you some of my patterns I still struggle with and tell you some others that I didn't let go of until I met Ginger in my 40s. And I mean, these things can really hang on. So,
yep.
About it the same? Yep, go ahead.
Yeah,
Mike,
we
ahead.
Are. In fact, when you brought up the topic when you were introducing us, Peter, about can't think of anything more important than self-sabotage except perhaps love, we agree with that 100%. In fact, we are discovering that self-sabotage is probably the number one obstacle in the way of love and compassion, both for yourself and for other people. It is the obstacle. And one of the things we're exploring is how we actually get attached to it. It's as if self-sabotage, self-destructive tendencies have a certain psychological gravity where we just get drawn into them over and over and over. And then to make matters worse, we hide the mechanism
from ourselves, and we just keep repeating the same old behaviors and emotions again and again, and end up in this old familiar place. It's like an old comfortable shoe or something that we put on, and we sort of throw up our hands and say, how did I get here again? And that's the pattern, often a lifelong pattern, that we're discovering how to unravel. And it's really quite an aha when people begin to understand how they end up in that same old place over and over again.
And when it comes to love, I mean, this is kind of the area I really like to focus on and that my heart goes out to, is the relationships we're in that we compromise because of our own attachments, and we're not really able to express that love to one another, and we end up ruining our relationships and getting divorced and all of these things because of our attachments that we don't even know are going on. It's like having this person living in your house with you that keeps messing up your relationship that you have no control over. You know, and once you can say, oh, who's this person? Get out of here. You know, then you can actually start your relationship. I've written a lot of articles on how to improve your relationships with your spouse by just recognizing your own attachments and theirs so that you can have more compassion for them and change the way you respond to their attachments, and they can change the way they respond to yours, and then you can work through your own.
Can you give some examples? Just of the kinds of things people think and the way they behave that is self-sabotaging, self-defeating, self-destructive.
Yeah, we find that there are three general categories, and we can talk about each category, but there are three general categories that these attachments, these self-sabotaging attachments, fall under. One is that we can get attached to rejection. We can get attached to deprivation, or we can get attached to being controlled. And we can sort of break each category down. When we're talking about relationships, a common one is that Hope and I have sort of had our experiences with in our relationship is an attachment to deprivation. An attachment to deprivation means that you unconsciously or unwittingly seek out, believe it or not, situations and do behaviors that lead you to being deprived of what you need. And you end up in this place of not getting your needs met, and you end up there over and over and over again. So one of these, I don't know, maybe actually Hope talks about this in one of our videos.
Yeah, I can explain an example of that if you like.
Yeah.
So say there is a video that I talk about, people watch on our site, where I talk about how I'm doing, you know, running around, taking care of everything all day, our kids, the house, business, all of these kinds of things, and I'm feeling like Mike's just sitting around doing his own thing. And so in my head, I start condemning him and end up pushing myself away from him and take on all the responsibility on myself instead of, and so then I end up with a bad attitude towards him, right, which cuts off the love. And so instead, I have to stop, realize that path I'm going in my head, down that negative path, and say, all I need to do is speak up and tell him what I need, instead of assuming that he's not going to meet it. And so as soon as I step up and say that, then I give him the opportunity to meet it, and everything's wonderful. But we end up sabotaging our relationships, you know, within the deprivation attachment, by not saying what we need from another person and just going along believing that they aren't going to give it to us. And so we start depriving ourselves by second-guessing their behaviors or by deciding that I want to be deprived of my needs so I can be angry with them or so I can get in the way of the love or whatever, and I'm not actually getting my needs met. That's an example of what women do, I think, pretty regularly. That's what I hear from a lot of women. It's kind of like it's like a martyr-type personality.
And so to sort of add to that, let's say, I mean, so the question in my mind now becomes, how do we end up in a position where we're doing that, where we're in a place where we have a need, and the other person may or may not know about it, but in the quickest way to get that need met is to express it and give the other person an opportunity, and yet we don't do that. And we condemn that other person, or we condemn ourselves. We tell ourselves that, you know, we're not worth it, or it's no use, or what have you. But we close down the opportunity to get that need met, and we end up feeling deprived. How do we end up in a place where we do that over and over and over
why?
Again? And why? And it has to do, of course, with if we go way back, well, it has to do with our history and our childhood. Let's say that we were raised in an environment where our needs were not met. Well, one of the things that happened, and this pattern called the pleasure and displeasure pattern, was discovered by one of the few great psychiatrists. He was a psychoanalyst, an MD. His name was Edmund Bergler. He was a colleague of Freud's. Nobody's ever heard of Bergler, and my theory about why that's the case is because his stuff is really, really effective, and modern mental health didn't want to have anything to do with it.
And it was, too, and it was a pretty radical idea.
It was a radical idea at the time.
Well, what's the idea?
Well, the idea is this, is that when, as you're being raised and you begin to experience, I mean, you're coming out of the womb where you don't experience deprivation, you don't experience, you're surrounded by warmth and your needs are met before you can even experience them, and you come out into this cold world and you have to wait for your food and other people will attempt to control you, and there's a lot of different factors that go into that, and you may have parents that quite frankly don't meet your needs. And so if we're talking about deprivation, so you're raised in an environment, let's say, where your needs are not being met. You're ignored, you're neglected, and you're not loved. And what happens is you build up a tolerance for it that you don't have anything to compare it to. You cannot filter that out and say, well, this is my mother's issue here, that's my father's issue, and it doesn't have anything to do with me. No, when you're a kid, that's the world that you're in, and that's the world that you learn to tolerate and that becomes familiar to you. And therefore, an attachment forms. In other words, that's what you learn to gravitate towards throughout your life. And so it's very likely that as you grow older, you're going to maintain the status quo, and this is an attachment. And so now, and then again, the bummer of all this is that you hide it from yourself. And so you learn, I'm not going to express my needs. Well, not expressing your needs is the very thing that will keep your needs from being met. Maybe you'll attract somebody into your life, a life partner, that's emotionally unavailable and therefore can't connect with you. Maybe you've learned to expect disappointment, that people won't be there for you, and therefore you miss the opportunities to be fulfilled.
Or maybe you do find somebody that can fill your needs, but it's not satisfying, that deprivation attachment you have, and so you break up with them.
Right, yeah. The people who are available, it's not hitting on that attachment. In other words, it's unfamiliar to you. It's not what you're, I don't want to say programmed for, but it's just coming from a different place. And so those people you may tend to avoid. And again, you think that's just, it's sort of like a fish in water. The fish is there going, what water? I don't know what water you're talking about. It's so much a part of you that you end up seeking that out over and over and over again without really realizing how you're creating it. And that is what we call an attachment. And it leads to sabotaging yourself over and over and over again. I mean, you have needs. They can be met. And yet you're unwittingly taking the course that goes in the opposite direction. And this is what our program is about. It's just been such, Peter, it's just been such a revelation to us personally, in our personal lives, in our families, with our extended families, in our relationships, that we've created this program in order to educate people about it. Because when you get the aha and you go, oh my gosh, if I look at my life and I look at my behaviors and the things I do, it's sort of like you could look at it, if you put on a filter, if you have a deprivation attachment, and I tell my clients this, I say, you wake up in the morning and you go, okay, unconsciously, I'm going to be seeking to have my needs not met. I'm going to be seeking that old familiar place of emptiness today. I'm going to catch myself doing it, denying opportunities to be fulfilled, sort of keeping my goals, keeping the things I want in life at arm's length. people are blown away at how they go about their day actually very skillfully avoiding opportunities to have their needs met. And the same goes for the deprivation and the attachment to being controlled.
The rejection.
Well, rejection and the attachment.
I think what you're working on, what you're doing is very, very, very important. I put a little different spin, but maybe it's not different. So let me suggest how I look at it.
Okay.
I personally avoid suggesting to people that they are unconsciously seeking to sabotage themselves, because most people take that as a humiliation, and it's not what they're actually thinking. The way I tend to view it and to encourage people to view it is that the results of their behavior is self-sabotaging, but it's not what they're directly seeking. They're seeking a moment of peace. They're seeking an end to anxiety. They're seeking to avoid the horror of being rejected again. They're terrified of reaching out to the world because their parents made so clear to them you get killed for that. If other people don't kill you, we'll kill you for being successful. They're resentful and fearful parents. So I tend to emphasize more that we all are trying to get someplace rather than necessarily consciously avoiding or unconsciously, but that there's such fear from what we've experienced and such underlying helplessness in all of us that it's very easy to get attached, in your words, to approaches that are really undoing us again and again and again without our having the faintest idea that's what we're doing or intending to do. Is that a little different, or are we on the same wavelength?
We focus additionally on that as well. We kind of consider it your conscious wants, right? And then your unconscious actions, kind of that way. And so we all want love, we all want peace, we all want those kind of things, and I might be seeking out to be accepted by others, but what are the things that I'm doing that I'm unconsciously doing that are causing me not to be accepted? And when I can see the difference between those things, now I can align what I really want and get the things that I really want by noticing what I'm doing unconsciously and make other choices to really get those things met that I really do want.
Yeah, I like what you say, Peter, in that the element of self-blame, I really strive to remove from the equation here. In other words, I do not want this to be an opportunity for somebody to blame themselves for what they're doing.
Exactly.
Because consciously, I think all of us want something similar, which is to live in happiness and harmony and peace and to respect ourselves and be respected by others and respect others. I mean, I think all of us want something similar that's in that area. And so what we like to say is, and yet we unwittingly work against that at times. And in a way, we blind ourselves to it. Let me give you another example. Have you ever sought the approval of someone that over a period of time demonstrated that they would never approve of you? I just had this awakening with my brother. My brother and I have very, very, I won't give you our sordid family history here, but we have very, very different interests, a lot of dynamics in the family that have made it, and just sort of probably genetic things. We're just, if you write down on a list, column A and column B, what our interests are, there couldn't be two different people in terms of interests. So we're not friends. And yet I, for many, many years, I mean, I'm 45 years old, so I'm going to say for, over four decades, I sought the approval of my older brother in many different ways, and I'll spare you the laundry list of ways, and never once over that period of time, in spite of whatever effort I made, did he give any nod of approval or show any interest whatsoever. And I would walk away from every interaction feeling rejected. And then I got to thinking to myself, what is it when you're seeking the approval of someone who has never showed any interest whatsoever, has never approved? Isn't that very, very close to setting yourself up for or even seeking rejection? if I grew up being rejected over and over, and that was sort of the place of familiarity to me, that had psychological gravity to me, and I sort of unwittingly sought that place out with him over and over again. It's like, wait a minute. I'm just returning to that old, familiar
place. The place I might differ, and you might change my mind, but the place I might differ, and what I think is a little bit more honoring the other person, maybe, is to say, you're not seeking the disapproval. God knows it hurts you, but you've learned a pattern which is guaranteed. In fact, I think that you weren't seeking disapproval from your brother. I would say that you wanted with all your heart to get his approval, and you kept trying and trying and trying because it's the only thing you knew, because to just say goodbye to him was too frightening, guilt-provoking. I would emphasize more just that energy that goes into the trying and the failure. It's a difference, and we don't have to go on any further with it.
No, I like what you said. You said,
yeah,
I learned...
I wouldn't come back to your seeking rejection. I don't think anybody seeks rejection.
I don't think anybody consciously seeks rejection. I think people unconsciously have, like you said, have learned a pattern. Like you said, they've learned a pattern that takes them back to this old familiar place over and over
again.
Trying
to get blood from a stone,
exactly.
hoping, and being afraid to leave the stone.
But yet being afraid to leave the stone. They don't want it. That's not what they want at all.
Exactly.
But it's what they've learned. And anything else might seem unfamiliar
to them.
Scary.
Scary.
And that fear leads you right back into what's familiar.
Yeah.
And so the challenge is to get beyond that fear and explore some safe and yet unfamiliar territory, letting go of trying to get blood from the stone. And that's what letting go of attachments is all about.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're emphasizing that, because when, in fact, you finally do learn to express your needs and you're in a relationship that you've created on the basis of a very limited expectations, because you've been dealing with stones as a child, you may actually not succeed. You may discover that you really want love, but that person can't give it, can't receive
exactly.
it, and isn't going to do the work, and maybe you never loved them anyway. You were just desperate.
Yeah, and in a way, letting it go and not asking somebody for something that they can't give is more respectful to them, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay,
yeah.
I'll stop pressuring you for this and go about and turn in a different direction. That's actually a very respectful thing to do.
Well, and what I've found as well is when you can see another person's attachment, when you can see, when I can recognize, and I'll just use Mike as an example, when I can recognize his rebel behavior, which is a control attachment, I don't have to take it personally anymore. I don't have to take that he's saying things to me, or I don't have to take his behavior as something he's doing to me, because I can see that he's just in his own thing going on. I can have compassion for him, you know, that he's acting out certain ways that go along with that attachment, that are feeding into that attachment. And when I can see that, I don't have to take it personal, and I can have compassion, and I can have more love. It really, really helps, and I can also help him
yes.
see that, and he can
yeah.
recognize that behavior, and he can kind of stop that as well. It makes
well, I'm glad you
difference.
Mentioned that. We're going to go to break, but I love what you just said, Hope, and I'd like to come back to it. We really do influence each other. There's a really mistaken idea out there in therapy that you can't change the other person. Actually, with love, patience, and tolerance, all things are possible.
Yep.
I'm enjoying this. We'll be back after break. Dear Bregan, I'm with my guests, Hope and Mike. Mike and Hope Bundrant, Bundrant. Although Mike didn't put this in his little intro for me. You can read his great stuff on naturalnews.com. Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, has this marvelous website. And I blog on that regularly now. Today I just sent in a blog that's so relevant to what we're talking about today. I sent in a blog about, you know, the solution to psychosis, emotional overwhelm, serious distress. And the solution I talk about is love. And I describe love and explain why all healing processes in the family, in our personal relationships and therapy, I think in politics and religion, if it's going to work, it's got to have a foundation of caring, fellow feeling, treasuring each other, loving, that it's just really the foundation of life. And in that, of course, I just put into my own words what wise human beings have been saying in philosophy and religion since the beginning of time. I welcome back Mike and Hope Bundrant, B-U-N-D-R-A-N-T, co-founders of INLP, the INLP Center.org or com. What is it? .com. So INLP welcome back. You've taken a breath. Where do you want to go?
Hope, where do you want to go?
Yeah, what do you want to talk about? By the way, have you two ever done this before together as one on a race?
You know, we do on Mike's radio show, Mental Health Exposed, on Natural News Radio. I'll join him often, and we'll discuss whatever the topic is for that day.
Okay. You seem real comfortable at it.
We spend a lot of time together.
Yeah.
Oh, I do too, but my wife, she considers me the pretty face. She doesn't participate. I'm the one out front.
I got to tell you, I'm trying to encourage Hope to be the one out front because she's the brains behind this operation, and yet she's shy about letting everyone know. I mean, we've got this AHA Solution program. We talk about these three attachment categories, and then we come up with 12 attachment types, four under each category. And for me, I'm digging through out-of-print, rare books back from the days of Freud, books by Edmund Bergler, and I'm trying to piece all this stuff together, and I'll talk to Hope, and she'll just figure it out in a few minutes. You know, I'll spend hours on this stuff trying to, you know, and so she's really, we got to get her more in the limelight, don't you think, Hope?
No.
I hope you actually have a really good speaking voice.
Thank you.
You sing?
I'm too busy. We have a lot of children and a couple businesses, so I'm pretty busy.
Have you ever sung?
No.
Been a singer?
No.
Because you have a lovely voice. I'm very aware of this because my wife makes me listen to all the singing shows, you know, on the air.
Like American Idol and everything?
Yeah, The Voice, and it's all of them. So I'm very aware now of voices and how they strike folks. You have a very lovely voice.
Thank
Are you both at the same microphone, as you said? Because you sound real different.
No, we're on two different phones, but on the same line.
Right, you're on two different lines.
Same line.
And your line, Hope, is your line's a little clearer.
Oh.
Your voice.
Funny,
because
I'm on the line. Hope's on a portable, and I'm on the actual hard line, so that's funny.
Maybe she's just got more of a crystal voice.
She's got better spiritual energy, I think, drawing.
Listen, it's wonderful to talk to a couple. Bless you. What about love? Come on, what about love?
Love is hard.
Love is hard. Do you actually have a program about love? Do you deal with it directly?
Well, we do have another program called Cooling the Fire, and it's about understanding the intention behind what a person's saying.
It's a conflict resolution
program.
Yes, you're not dealing directly with what is love and how do we do it. I think
you need
to do that. You guys sound very loving. It would be wonderful for you to try to.
It's interesting, Peter. We find that our love flows very naturally without having to do much. Hold on a second now.
I love you guys. This is fun. Go ahead.
Listen, once the obstacles are out of the way, right? And I've got plenty of obstacles, right? And so, it, the love that flows through me gets sort of gummed up in these obstacles. But the more I remove the obstacles and don't, you got to agree with this, Hope, right?
Okay.
The more I remove the obstacles the easier it is to relate and the more it is to be in love. Wouldn't you agree with that, Hope?
Well, I'd agree with that, and I'd also agree that there's about 2 weeks out of the month that I'm really good with love. And then the other 2 weeks, no.
Oh, well, listen, let me give you a definition of love.
Okay.
To me, love is joyful awareness. That's it, joyful awareness. And it's not sad, it's not depressed, it's not angry, it's not frustrated. It's joyful awareness. So it's like that feeling when your dog greets you. It's like the sunset. It's like the sense that God loves you. It's like looking at your wife and thinking, I'm blessed. I'm blessed by the curve of her nose. I'm blessed by the smile. I'm blessed by the look in her eye. And so I like to think that we want to have this positive vision that inspires us to know when we're feeling. And I like to feel every day, again and again, blessed and happy and joyful about my ginger.
That's what I was thinking. It sounds like it has a lot to do with gratitude.
Oh, it does. It has so much to do with gratitude. And you can feel it so much. You know that this is... See, I agree 100% about getting rid of the obstacles.
Yeah.
But you also, in this crazy world we live in, need to have an exuberant concept that you can reach toward. We have a new dog in our lives. Over this 6 months, is a little miniature of a Sheltie. There's no such thing as a miniature Sheltie. It just got delivered to us because Ginger needed a smaller dog.
Mm-hmm.
And this little dog has brought exuberance and love and joy into our lives. And it's getting the old dog to play, and it's getting all of us to play together. And being a Sheltie, it herds us into one space, gets us all on the bed, and makes us play. I'm not kidding. And so this is like such a part of my way of viewing life. I just want to share it with you. And it will be up, I hope, on naturalnews.com. Within a day, probably, because we did just send in my discussion of this. But so I want to encourage you also to move in this direction of thinking that love should just be there all the time, and the other part will gradually fade while you also work on it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
It makes a big difference.
I agree 100%. That's the context where healing takes place.
And that's what we're trying to really do is, you know, we find, you know, even your relationship with God can change when you're not sabotaging all of the efforts, right? And so, you know, a big part of it is for us and trying to help others is really helping them see the things that they're doing in their life that are keeping them from really appreciating one another, seeing one another, how they are, and, you know, and having that gratitude for one another and for who that other person is in their life. And so much of the time, like you said, Peter, all this other stuff is in the way, and we really need to be able to just clearly see that goodness in the other person.
Well, I hear a lot of love shining between the two of you, and I think it would be a gift to just make it a real central aspect of what you're doing for other people, too. I think it's really important, but here I am. I'm really sort of being intrusive. I apologize.
I like the way you describe love, Peter, as a joyful awareness, and to me, that's the awareness that heals. It's not a technique. It's just an awareness, and when you have awareness of the right things in that space, you have healing. And are you also suggesting that it's learned?
I think it's God-given, or if you're secular, evolutionary-given. We are such social beings that love is the whole glue of our nature. It's what keeps us from becoming psychotics. You know, we're born into fear and helplessness, and we grow into human beings. And I think that other people's caring for us and our learning to care, but in a happy way, not just in a struggling way with other people, is just absolutely key to everything, and that every human being has been given that capacity. I wouldn't give up on anyone. And I like to think of it as that we want to become sources of love. We want to be a source of love. and that that would change us and change the people around us. And it also, so interesting for me, it protects me from people who are angry and hateful, because if I'm in a loving space, every negative intrusion is really obvious. Whereas if I'm not in a loving space, I don't notice the evil around me as much.
Well, and we notice so much difference because we have, between us, we have a blended family. We have 8 children, and
wow.
Three of them are older. 5 of them live with us pretty regularly. And I mean, you can tell such a difference in our relationships with our children when we're in a loving place and when we're not in a loving place. I mean, there's so much conflict. There's so much angst. You know, between all the different people when we move out of, especially as the parents, when we move out of that place and aren't approaching them in a love type attitude, you know, and we're maybe in a different kind of an attitude. It's just, I mean, the quickest way to change someone else's behavior is be loving towards them. It's amazing.
Yes, usually positive, but not always, because people can get frightened. And
yeah.
They can run. It's their privilege. And some people even get jealous. But mostly I have found that if you're in a loving space, the folks who aren't find it really hard to be around, and they just ease away without hurting you or
yeah.
trying to hurt you.
And I'm talking about just our kids who want us to be loving to them.
Yes. And it
well,
doesn't stop
and if you look, if you look
yeah,
at the therapy context, I think that's one of the things that makes therapy or coaching powerful, if not the thing, is that as the therapist, you're seeing from in the context of love or great respect, at any rate, unconditional respect, you're seeing something good in the other person that they're not seeing. And as a therapist, you don't let it go. You hold on to that. You hold that context for them, and you hold that expectation for them. And as they relate with you, it rubs off. And they may resist it like crazy. They might not be used to it, might not be familiar at all. But over time, it rubs off, and they learn to see in themselves what you have seen in them. And to me, that's the gift of therapy. I'm sure you have an experience that's similar to that, Peter.
Oh, I'm totally with you. I thought about it a lot watching the NCAA basketball tournament. And you see these winning coaches, and they love their ball players, both on
yeah.
the men and the women's side of the game. They love their players, and they really want their players to love each other. It's very, very clear.
Yeah. Yeah,
you can
imagine a lot of those
kids have never been loved like that before in their lives.
Well, I had the distinct pleasure before he passed on of interviewing Coach John Wooden. And
oh, my.
His players, I mean, some of the greats, you know, Bill Walton and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and some of the great. I mean, he loved his players so much, and that was the basis of being able to hold such incredibly high expectations for them. From
mm-hmm.
them, but even his expectations were respectful. It's just that you are going to do the very best of which you're capable, and he was able to draw that out of them because of his just incredible regard for them. And none of them, I mean, it was an unforgettable experience for all of them, regardless of whether they went on to NBA fame or not. He was like a father figure, and often the very
yeah.
first person that really
yeah.
loved them.
So what we're talking about applies everywhere,
yeah.
and you can be sure these coaches have some way of dealing with the self-defeating, or what you're calling the self-sabotage of the players, because a lot of these youngsters are going to come in full of self-sabotage, and I'm sure that a big part of the coaching is finding ways around that. I don't want to take us off too much in sports. My last... show last week was on, was with a sports guy. His job is to, you know, help people with their athletics and become better and to learn more from it and do more with it. And the sports coach. And so it's spilling over a little today. These are universal. It doesn't matter what you're doing.
Right. Well, I've found it, and again, with our kids, because that's my big priority. But, you know, the more loving I am, the more able they are to, the more authority I have over them in terms of getting them to do what I need them to do or to behave correctly or any of those kinds of things, you know, it really goes hand in hand, that really showing love to really be able to parent well, you know, and being able to discipline. They respond to the discipline, they respond to the expectation so much better when I'm coming from such a loving place and when I have such a love relationship with them. It's so much more effective.
You know,
when teachers in school, you can really tell when they really, really like their students. The students respect them so much more. You know, it has a big difference there.
You know, we're talking about this, some incredibly important things. The context of love, we're talking about how change takes place and what really makes a difference in people's lives. And I'm thinking of something you and I have talked about before, Peter, which is, these are powerful principles. And let's compare this to, say, doing a therapeutic technique on someone. And I can talk about this because I've been teaching NLP. I teach it in a very different way than it's traditionally taught, but I've been teaching NLP, which is mostly considered a very techniquey-oriented, strategic approach. Come on in, and I'm going to perform some technique on you. I'm going to reprogram your brain, push a few buttons, and you can walk out. And, of course, that whole paradigm, I think, is just completely bogus. That's not what NLP is.
I am so glad you're saying this, because I, on the basis of our friendship and respect for my guest, I was holding a little back on that. So I'm very glad to be.
Well, it is. I know enough about NLP that I know all of the techniques. And, you know, there are some that work. You can sit down with someone with a simple phobia and lead them through some steps. And it really works. There are some things that really work. On the whole, NLP is not about techniques. It's about, it is the study of the structure of subjective experience, which is very, very different than doing a technique. Very, very different. It's about exploring how the mind works and how to gain greater control over it. But, you know, it's been turned into something, and a lot of cognitive behavioral approaches, there's a whole lot of technique-y stuff where, you know, go here, tap on your cheek here to feel better. There's a lot of ticky-tacky technique-oriented stuff that passes off as psychology or mental health that is bogus, in my view, because at the at very best, it is a temporary state shift, but it is not addressing an underlying problem. It does not require the kind of relationship that we're talking about in terms of respect and unconditional love. It's a surfacey kind of approach, and we very much move in the opposite direction of these surface-oriented approaches, even where communication skills are important, and there are language patterns, there's all kinds of skills to learn. But underlying that are deeper things, like the attachment, self-sabotage that we're talking about, and all of this is, if you really want to change, it has to be driven in the context of love.
Well, I'm with you. Mike and Hope, what's your training background? I'm kind of curious about it.
My background is a mental health counseling. And so I'm licensed in the state of New Mexico, and I retired my license. I worked as a licensed mental health counselor in the state of New Mexico for 10 years in Albuquerque and Santa Fe. And I left the field. I worked at an agency under a psychiatrist and under a clinical psychologist. And
what a nightmare.
It was an absolute nightmare when the kind of supervision I got was, have you referred them for a med evaluation? It's like, no, I haven't. Well, you need to do that, and that's your supervision. I even had a psychiatrist bet me $20 that if I referred my client and they went on meds that they'd get better. He bet me $20. He goes, there's your supervision. It's a bet. And for those reasons, I left the system entirely and just went into private practice on my own and said, I'm not going to take insurance, I'm not going to do any of that stuff. If I'm going to provide something of value to people, then they'll certainly write me a check. And if I can't provide something of value, then they won't write me a check, and then I shouldn't be doing it. And I practiced that way for several years.
Mike, this is going to become, I think, more and more what people do as we get into national health care, and it just totally immerses everybody in a real mechanical, limited system. And people are going to be doing just what you do, I think. Now, what do you call yourself then when you identify yourself?
I just call myself a person. Person. I'm trying to be the best person.
You don't try to find a niche like unofficial therapist.
No.
I usually call myself a coach. I won't diagnose. I won't refer. I won't, if people say I've got blah, 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 blah disorder, I say, I don't treat anything.
Yeah.
I've got an educational program. Watch it. Listen to it. By the way, we've got a free 20-minute video at the INLP Center that people can go to and watch about self-sabotage. Go to the INLPcenter.com, put in your email address, upper left, and people can watch a free 20-minute video about this. And then people watch that video, I say, I can help you identify this and what's going on in your life and so forth. But I'm very, very, I won't do anything that you could put the word clinical behind because I don't believe in that model.
I think you are the future. How about you, Hope? Did you have any training in the field?
Yourself
out?
No, I just kind of put things together. You know, growing up, my mom always had me in therapy. So maybe that's where it comes from. And having a pretty challenging life and having to navigate it, you know, and having a bunch of children and making that my priority to do my best, you know, taking my responsibility as a mom is, you know, my number one priority. So
yeah. Well, it's a marvelous to be getting to know the both of you because my awareness has been, you know, just Mike and I sharing the critical views of psychiatry, but I'm sure we've also talked some about the issues of love and all. But this is wonderful. I think it will be encouraging to people who really want to think about the essence of providing service. And do you do it by getting all these degrees, or do you do it by actually becoming a certain kind of person who knows how to offer a certain kind of help? Yeah.
Yeah.
We are getting near the end. It crept up on me. I was so excited I didn't even see the 2-minute warning from my marvelous engineer, who's now signaling me, Giselle, that we're coming near to an end. My guests, Mike and Hope and Mike Bundron. You can also get Mike on naturalnews.com and also at the INLP Center online. Hey, thank you guys for being on the show with me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.